Hey, from this bitch of an earth, it's your host Diana, and this episode I sat down with Amber to talk about being a dungeon master and how they manage players in tabletop games. So, as always, sit back and chill. You've earned it. Everybody, welcome to episode 4 of This Bitch of an Earth. I'm here with Amber.
Hi, everybody.
And we're going to be talking about GMing. We already did an episode on D&D, but this is going to be a bit more granular, bit, you know, more niched down.
A peek behind the screen, perhaps.
Because Amber and I both GM. They GM
D&D.
Dungeons & Dragons, mostly.
Yeah, 5th edition.
Yeah, and I do Shadowrun. So,
and while they're like different systems, in terms of like creating stories and narratives for your players, they're similar in a lot of ways, but their differences are interesting.
I still haven't honestly still haven't figured out how to like do that without railroading people.
Yeah, that's
hard.
That is one of the hardest problems because, of course, like the sandbox is kind of what you want, what everybody wants.
Yeah.
But you can't exactly prepare.
I know, you can't just like
a whole like every under every stone you'll find a quest kind of world.
Yeah.
And in fact, I feel like that's a problem with a lot of like people who want to get into GMing is like. Mm-hmm. You're like, okay, next week is going to be, like, our session. First thing I got to do is, like, well, most people think, like, oh, first thing I got to do is make a world for my players to inhabit. And while that's not exactly a bad thing, it's just, like, a lot of people start there, but then they never finish creating a world. And at that point, like, write a book instead of write a campaign. Because it'll never live up to what you're writing as a world, because like your players won't. Like for example, if you make a tavern and you describe the tavern and you're like, oh, there's a tapestry that's kind of torn on the wall, but on the other end there's a bunch of brigands and people like ready to fight you. Your players might go like with your plot about the brigands and fighters ready to fight you, but they might also be like, "Whoa, that torn piece of tapestry on the wall is like its key. It's like, you know,
this is the thing we need to focus on." Yeah,
and in some ways that can be a blessing for other things, but for like
yeah, because sometimes goofs become major plot devices.
Yeah, and especially like something that the players picked upon that wasn't really what you wanted them to pick upon, you can use that fact later on to like kind of like at the end of an arc you tie that in
to wrap it in
and from their point of view, like they didn't know that there was a whole thing that they never touched upon. From their point of view, it's like it's like mind blown. The tapestry was the key to like the universe.
Yeah. So you said you had some talking points, which is very generous. I know that's kind of like a sloppy transition, but so like I guess the plot aspect of GMing.
I feel
how do you like write it so that you have a sandbox, but also like a healthy like amount of adaptation?
I think in order to have a good sandbox is to have like an overarching conflict in your world. For example, I've heard of somebody who's doing one where it's chaos versus like not really control but more like order, and that's like the overriding conflict of their whole campaign. You know, within the campaign they'll do like normal like dungeon crawling and like other things, but through and through like the whole theme is like is chaos better or is control or like order better? And by having like an overarching conflict, you can frame a lot of, you can even, every NPC that they're going to encounter, you can frame them along an axis, whether they're more towards order or more towards chaos. And this makes like very dynamic characters, which have like, they lean towards one of those two aspects that your world is framed by. And so, depending on which characters they like lean into, you can then present them with, you know, like they lean into a character that's very about order, and because they see it as like, you know, maybe they lean towards like the mayor of the city that they're in, because he puts order and justice, and they see that as like a virtuous thing. But then, well, after they've done a couple of like quests for this character that they really like, you could then show the other side of the coin of like the evils of having a super ordered society, you know, show like stratification or something like that, you know. And then and then now your characters are really in like there's this dramatic pressure to pick a side.
Okay.
And I think for Sandbox, that's like one of the best tools that you can use, because you know, any quest that you can have, you can easily tie it back into that overarching conflict and create like a bigger narrative. While I'm talking, I'm making like these grand gestures with my hands, which is great for an audio format.
Oh yeah, totally. So I guess talk about like tools you can use in the sandbox to hook players into like something you want to get them to, or is that like the wrong way of thinking about it?
I don't think so, because I think that it's not wrong to try to hook your players into something, because if it's interesting enough, they'll hook themselves at some point.
Okay. Interesting.
But of course there's something to be said about like you're kind of like taking agency away and railroading them, but
yeah,
in some cases like you have to do that, because I say you have to do that when it conflicts with other things. Like for example, if you have like a party where everybody's being like putting aside alignment, they're just being good people, you know, your characters are just like doing the good thing, but then one character's, I'm gonna be like a bastard. If you
an irascible,
yeah,
bastard character.
My alignment is bastard stupid. Then you're left with like two choices, which is like, do you let them ruin the fun for everybody else, which is it's likely to happen, or do you try to like railroad them in a different direction? Like perhaps instead of being like antagonistic, they're just like they have ulterior motives, you know. They're not evil to the party. They just like, as soon as they get the gold, they'll backstab everybody else. Which then, even if that like backfires and it actually gets the party killed, at least everybody has died for a reason, you know? Not just because Jim was being an asshole that wanted to kill everybody. It was because Jim's character is all about money and backstabbed us. And that leaves less of a sour taste in the player's mouth. Like,
yeah.
Like,
I can understand that it would be like less sour, but like, cause that's still pretty...
Yeah.
Jim was being a dick.
He was being a dick, but then at least, you know, my character died for something and not for the whims of my friend Jim, you know?
Yeah.
And character death is something that is always, it's hard to deal with. I think one of the, if you're going to start jamming, or if you're GMing, you have to tell your players what type of experience your campaign will be. Like, will it be, is life cheap in this world? Like,
yeah.
Or is it, you know, are you allowed to get really into your character because maybe they don't have plot armor, but the encounters won't be deadly.
Mm. So, like, a session zero would probably be good to work yeah. out all of those, like, expectations.
Yeah, session zeros, I've learned, are if not non-optional, they're super, you almost must have to do them, because,
yeah.
Especially if you want to do a sandbox, it helps to do a session zero where everybody's doing their characters together, because... Mm-hmm. You literally couldn't get two...
Then you can, like, you can build off each other.
Yeah, yeah, you can get two players who are like, I want to be a half-elf, and the other one's like, I want to be a half-elf too. Wouldn't it be cool if, like, we were cousins? Yeah. And I mean, that happened with one of the players in our game. He became a cousin of an NPC, but that wasn't because of a...
Oh my god.
That wasn't because... Of a session zero. That was just because I had to tie them in somehow to the world.
This is another thing about, like, the goofs being the funniest, like, best plot lines.
Oh, yeah, because there's... Yeah.
To pull back the curtain a little bit. So, Amber is GMing a game for me and, like, a few other people. One of which is Deary. And so Amber has this NPC named Maximus, which my character, like, successfully romanced the first time they, like, spent more than 2 hours together. And then the next week... like, Deary showed up for D&D because the schedules finally matched up.
Yeah.
And Deary just decided to be Maximus's cousin.
Yeah, yeah. I was like...
because...
Oh, Deary, like, you'll show up at the castle because you're here to, like, do something with the mayor, yeah. who's Maximus. And here, like, you have total liberty of what the reason you want to go to the castle to is. And he was like...
Yeah.
Cousin!
Cousin, lover.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Then he had this whole. Yeah, then he said that they were lovers as children, not just cousins.
It's really wild.
I don't think Deary knows that Maximus is adopted.
Oh yeah. He's gonna listen to this.
But it also that you know, for a sandbox type of game. Like, not only do you have your overarching conflict, within your characters, as they interact with the NPCs and the world itself, they will develop, like, dramatic tensions between them. Because between you and Deary, yes. there's this tension about romance with Maximus.
Not really. I think it's one-sided.
It really is one-sided. Deary's just a little envious.
Deary just... Yeah.
But it,
or no, what's his character's name?
Shardy. Shardy, yeah.
Yeah, Shardy's a little envious of Orianna. But anyway, neither here nor there. So, tying into the session zero, how do you facilitate, like, player interaction at the table? Because D&D is a very, like, the way people make their characters can be very experimental.
Mm.
And, let me know if you don't want to talk about this, because I don't want to, like, force you into a discussion that you don't want to have, but a lot of, like, characters or people will, like, subconsciously put their own trauma into their characters' backstories.
Yeah.
And then, like, try and bring it up on purpose so they can, like, get free therapy. I don't know if that's, like, a conscious decision that they're making or just, like, a thing that happens to happen more often than not.
Yeah.
But... How would you facilitate that?
Well, first off, you know, it is therapeutic, but it's not therapy. That must be said. That Correct. Must be put clear.
Yes.
But Dungeons & Dragons and most role playing games are role playing. Okay, let me rephrase that. Because you're allowed to role play. Of course there are people who tend to go to the extreme and they make, like, a character that's super out there, that's not anything like them, but a lot of people just do what they're comfortable with and they make themselves, you know? Like, what if,
yep.
what if,
Guilty.
You know, what if Diana was alive in the 13th century?
Yeah, what if I was a pirate and a bird and kind of dumb?
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, one way to facilitate that is to facilitate roleplay in itself. And, you know, one of the best pieces of advice and that I've applied to our games from Matt Mercer is, like, you don't necessarily have to do voices, but, like, playing out your NPCs helps, you know. If your characters walk into the inn, instead of being like, oh, the bartender's there, you know, washing the cups, you, like, literally do it, like, you pantomime it with your hands.
Yeah, do the motion.
And you're like, what's going on, everybody? And that, like, prompts your players to you know, open up and actually, like, you know, this isn't Amber behind the screen, like, making a character on the spot, you know. This is, like, this is the bartender. That's who they are.
Yeah.
Especially, like, with voices, like, you don't have to be a voice actor to be a GM or a player, because, like, you can make, like, the dumbest voice, but if you stick with it, everybody will recognize
everyone will accept it.
Yeah, you know. It's not like, oh, that's a really bad voice that you're making. That's just the really bad voice that character has.
Mm-hmm. So many wizards in scroll shops. Just have this very old frail voice. It's always so good.
because it also helps to lean into motifs of TV and books. You know, like every time that Dave asks to go to see the wizard, I always make it like an old bearded guy because. You know, I really like the animated Disney movie about Merlin.
Oh yeah, Sword in the
Stone.
Yeah,
Sword in the Stone. Yeah,
is that the one?
Yeah, so I always
Black Cauldron.
Yeah,
one of those.
I always picture Merlin as like the storekeeper or the wizard that Dave was speaking to, in contrast, like, you know, whenever you guys are in Talna in the city and you're talking to like the tailor or somebody like that, some like high-end shopkeeper, you know, I always put on like my fanciest French, like, what would you like today? Although that wasn't very French right there, but
it does that a lot speaking as a player, does that a lot. It's very good. It helps me roleplay too.
Yeah.
Because a lot of people don't like to like roleplay their character, especially if it's not in their comfort zone.
Yeah.
So I guess getting into your characters more and like changing up your voice and changing up your cadence and like acting out what the characters are doing helps people like inhabit their characters.
Yeah, exactly. And it's also important not to like pressure them into role playing, because
just like more make them feel comfortable with.
Yeah, and even
the aspect. A lot of
players are happy seeing their actor friend or the friend that's more extroverted doing the role playing and then playing a support role where they're just like nod. Like, I've literally seen Pat, who's I would argue is the least role play character that we have in our sessions.
Yeah.
He started to get into it, and he'll nod and he'll start pointing and stuff when he's speaking to people, even when he's speaking out of character. And to me, that's roleplay, even when you're out of character and actually, like, playing out the role of your character.
Yeah.
About going back to the thing about players putting their traumas into their characters, it's important in Session Zero, and it's one of the reasons why I say, like, it's almost a must to have a Session Zero, is to ask your players, hey, what are the things that we will not touch on this game? You know?
Yeah.
Like, for example, like, my game, or our game, is not gory, but it's, like, realistic. Like, I try to describe, like, the punches and the stuff.
Yeah.
But I know, like, I'll never go, like, overboard or super descriptive, like, oh, you know, like, the bone crunch and blah, 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 because of like Ash and Julia to some extent. Mm. And for example, like clowns are out of the question because of Julia.
Oh yeah.
But
that's a thank you.
The so it's important to have a session zero to like literally ask like what you know what can we and can't
yeah
we,
what do you want us you know? To stay away from,
you know, because like there's some people who like will play without asking their players, and they'll you know they come from like Game of Thrones high fantasy like background, and they're like, oh, and then like the you know the invaders come and they pillage and they rape and blah blah, and like your players don't want to hear that, you know. They'd rather imagine it or not imagine it at all, but not have their GM like literally tell them what's going on when it's like something that they don't want to hear. And it's also important to do that as a group, because then, you know, your other characters know, you know, what.
Yeah, then other people won't play into it if your GM won't. It's kind of like we all have an agreement to not bring this thing to the table.
Yeah, and you know, like if one of your players isn't playing by the rules, you know, you have to stop the game right then and there and say like, I don't think anybody is having fun because of what you're doing. You know, not everybody's comfortable. They're the same level of comfort as you, which is important, especially when your characters are there to play a character that in some part, even the most outlandish characters are in some part of you, you know, they're your adventurous side, your eloquent, crazy side that you don't like, you keep bottled up when you're sitting behind your desk at work. But, you know, come Saturday, D&D time, you become, you know, snot collector Bob.
Yeah. So, what else were we gonna say? I guess we talked about facilitating players.
Yeah.
We talked about plot a little bit.
Yeah. We could talk about...
Do you have...
Going back to, like, when people start making their world and then never stop. And the difference between railroad and sandbox. I think a really good place to start, and I kind of wish I had started our campaign like this, is a dungeon. Like, it's in the name of the game. But the reason why, like, I've grown to think that a dungeon is a really good place to start a campaign is because you don't need that much world building for a dungeon. You need to ask yourself, you know, what is this dungeon? Is it the grave of an old king and he was buried with all his magic items and that's why there's loot? Is it a temple? Is it like an underground city?
That way it makes sense.
Yeah.
Like if you want to start your characters at a higher level or like give them some buffs in the beginning.
Yeah, it also helps with that.
It's a good way to like...
But it also helps you as a GM to like pace yourself and not go go all crazy and make two pantheons, a continent, you know, different...
Are you...
Huh?
Are you speaking from experience?
Yeah, I'm speaking from experience here. because while Although, those things are...
I can say...
Well, go right ahead.
Uh-huh. Oh, I can say I'm going to use that pantheon in other games, so thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. But, I mean, like, yes, making a pantheon is really helpful for your players to, like, you know, identify who their characters are in this world, like, who they would pray to, or blah, and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. It's important not to, like, go into GMing thinking I'm going to be the next Tolkien and write the next Lord of the Rings. It's more important to think of it as, like, I'm going to make Saturday's session be fun.
Huh. Okay.
Because when you get caught up in the world that you're making, that... it does consciously or subconsciously, it'll never, like, what happens during the game will never live up to what you had expected of your players. Even if they check all the boxes, you know, maybe they took a turn too much in combat and they weren't the epic adventurers that you had in mind, you know.
They never are.
but yeah, by pacing yourself, by kind of like starting like with a very, you might say like a dungeon is very railroady, but it doesn't have to be. You can very easily make a dungeon that has like two paths, and as soon as they pick one path, the other one blocks off. For the rest of the game, they'll wonder like what was in that other like path of the dungeon.
Yeah,
you know, and it creates, even if it's not, you know, a real sandbox, it feels like a sandbox because there's choices being made.
Mm.
In fact, you know, this Saturday.
Oh, peek behind the curtain.
Yeah, peek behind the curtain. We're gonna continue the vampire plot that we have, but I'm also putting a dungeon in front of you guys to see which one you pick. Because I feel like we haven't had enough dungeon crawly type of experience. Especially because it's important to balance, you know, the type of game that you're playing. Mm-hmm. Especially because, you know, not every player wants to play the same game, and not every player that week wants to play the same game, you know?
Mm.
Like, Pat is super into the combat aspect and doesn't really like the role-playing part. So for him, a dungeon crawl would be his bread and butter. But, you know, it can't always be, you know, this is Murder Fest Part 5. You have to balance. You have to especially identify what your players want, what type of players they are. And there's like hundreds of YouTube videos that are like, oh, what to do if your player is like the strategist or the min-maxer, blah, blah, blah. But like, those like labels are valuable, especially for a GM who's like, how do I plan my encounters? Do I have to make them like hyper complicated because my players are like gods at risk and they know every move in chess? or should I make them more like grunt hit because that's the type of player that they are? I think more important than that, than those identities or those tags to players, it's more important to find their tag of like what type of adventure, what type of play style they like. Because like correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that you really like the like political, making allies, making enemies type of play style.
I do. Yeah.
Which is why.
Yeah, that's accurate. Yeah. I kind of do like doing cool things in combat, but only when I'm able to.
Yeah.
Like, as a level one monk, you know, I'm not gonna be like, yes, combat encounters, but when I can like cripple an opponent by like touching three pressure points, yes, that's cool.
But like,
interestingly enough, I never ever have played a character with high enough charisma to be like good at making political allies. But that's not going to stop me from trying.
Yeah, and I mean, like, you don't have to be like charming Don Juan to charm every NPC. You know, you can be real with them, and like, I'm sure that if you are your character, your GM will appreciate that, and some way or another, you know, the plot will unravel.
Yeah.
You know, it's not. You know, I funnily enough, Pat, the one who likes to roleplay the least, I gave him a charisma of 18.
Yeah.
And
he's just got a really like gentle aura about him.
Yeah, yeah. That's basically how it feels because like everybody just he rolls that natty 20 or that like 19, but he hasn't said anything in character. So then you just gotta pretend like everybody at the table is like, oh, you are so awesome.
Yeah.
But, yeah, as I was saying, like, for example, like, Yeah, you really like that, like making allies and enemies political kind of like game, because yeah. it provides a context to like the fights, the combat that yeah. happens
I
later.
I also do like
Because like you can't just like throw enemies at your players. I mean, you can, but it won't always work because they need to be motivated to like commit murder. You know?
Not gonna say that.
if you don't present your players with like a bad guy or an antagonist, if they're playing as evil characters, like somebody that's like foiling their plans or you know, ruining their ambitions, then they're just gonna become murder hobos or worse or alternatively become like peaceful, I don't wanna hurt anybody because like no one's really in my way.
Yeah.
But for example, with play styles, Dave and Pat don't really need that strong of a bad guy. They will like you put somebody that breathes in front of them, and they're like, I don't like the way that guy breathes.
It's true. It's true.
But even those types of players, you know, they will pick up on the nuances of the plot, especially if you have like the overarching kind of plot, you know, chaos versus order, or like nature versus civilization is another like classical struggle, you know. You know, they'll pick up on that and they'll be like, you know, my character's a druid. It makes more sense that they'd side with, you know, the free men than with, you know, the city watch. Mm-hmm. And so that will give them the context they need to not only to attack, but then to feel good about who they're attacking or what they're doing. You know, if they're going to do a heist on a bank, you know, if like you tell them like, oh, you know, the bank, the guards, they have a family, you've murdered them, you know, they won't feel good. But if you're like, oh, they have a family, but they were, you know, they were of your rival gang that will like mercilessly kill you, they won't feel as bad. Exactly.
If at all.
Yeah, that's why it's important to, you know, to balance out the types of play styles, to present your characters' plots with enemies, with, you know, with things to interact. I mean, that's the point, to see, you know, to present them with a sandbox or as close as a sandbox as you can muster, and see how they run amok with it.
Mm-hmm. Finish your thought.
I was just gonna say, like, you know, you'll have fun at D&D if your characters feel like they're in the world. You'll have fun playing the game, even if it's like, you know, the session where everybody goes shopping, because I mean, like, even in our campaign, like, you know, the session where everybody went shopping, at one point, you know,
we still had a combat.
Yeah, still had a combat encounter because Deary decided to steal Pat's money because, you know, Deary's a rogue and he felt like he wasn't in any real danger, or like there weren't any real consequences to his actions because he, you know, he was relatively new in the campaign, so he hadn't really felt a real combat encounter before that. So he was like, I'm just gonna do this. I'm just gonna antagonize the other player. And I felt like it was enough of a light thing to like allow to happen. And even in that like session where plot wise we did close to nothing, a lot of drama and then a lot of fun happened. I think you know, the GM, apart from like the role as like, you know, the world, their role in a lot of ways is like literally it's like a director. They're there to create drama or to like heighten the drama between the players and each other and the players in the world, because drama is fun.
Yeah.
It's exciting. It's thrilling. It's what makes you come back next week to continue the wild adventures of your character.
Mm. So I guess in closing, what's one piece of advice you could give aspiring GMs? And also, is there anything that we missed? Anything you wanted to discuss? The floor is yours.
Okay. Piece of advice for aspiring GMs. I think, honestly, a piece of advice that I should have taken is, don't disregard pre-made adventures because they're not yours. You can very easily apply them to the world that you will make or that you have made. And they're well made, and they can fit really well into your world. And they serve a purpose. They serve a purpose of creating a short-term or long-term, depends on the pre-made adventure, a plot that will really engage and make your players have fun. And the reason why I think that's a good piece of advice is because while you do a pre-made adventure, you're not exercising your skills as a GM of world building, but you are exercising all the other tools of, running NPCs, running encounters, engaging your players, creating drama, all of that stuff, which I'd say arguably is more important than creating a new Chronicles of Narnia for your players,
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Another good piece of advice is there's a lot of good advice out there on the internet, and a lot of those GMs like Matt Mercer, like Matt Colville, Monarch's Factory, they'll tell you GMs have been copying from each other since the beginning of the game, because you copy from each other because it works.
Yeah.
If you notice this guy's campaign worked to a T and it was awesome, just do it. Of course, ask them for permission, but quite frankly, just see what works and do it. You're not any worse of a GM because you didn't invent the wheel. There's other people who have.
Sound advice.
And lastly, of course, have fun. that's the whole point, is to have fun with your friends. Don't try to create this majestic theater dramatical piece. Just try to make a fun 3 to 5 hours on a Saturday, or however long you have, for you and your friends. And I think the best D&D or any role playing game groups are the ones that meet up not only to play their role playing game. They're friends who will have fun regardless of what they do that play session.
Yeah. Well said.
Thank you. I don't know. My mouth is dry. I've spoken so much. And I hope what I've said is good. Please don't yell at me on the internet.
We're almost done. No, you're good. You're fine. So where can everyone find you on the internet? If you want to be found.
Yeah,
if you don't want to be found, that's okay.
My Twitter is public. It's at pansnerdual, pun between pansexual and nerd.
It'll be linked.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, that's where you can find me. I will be trying to, to write a couple more threads than I usually do, because it's a cool place to not rant, but put your thoughts. So If you want to hear my thoughts, they'll probably be there.
Cool. You can find everything I do at either thelifecast.net or nert.co. K-N-U-R-T-T. And that's going to be it for this episode of This Bitch of an Earth. We'll see you in 2 weeks.
Bye, everybody.
Thanks for listening to This Bitch of an Earth. And wrapping up, we have a Twitter now. Follow TBOAE Podcast for new episodes and daily good morning tweets. For more Lifecast Network content, you can follow The Lifecast Net on Twitter and Instagram. As for myself, you can find everything I do at nert.co. Everything's linked in the show notes, and don't forget, suck less, fuck more, howl at the moon, dress in black, worship wholeheartedly.